afternoon. I'm Dick Rowe, a member of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Historical Society's Advisory Council, and the chair of its Oral Histories and Acquisitions Committee. I welcome you to this, and to you participants, to this, our fourth Oral Histories program. This program will, this roundtable will focus on investment management regulation. Once again, thanks to technology, our roundtable is being broadcast by live audio stream at www.sechistorical.org, and I welcome all of you that are listening in. I also invite you to visit the website for our virtual museum to listen to and read the transcripts of other roundtables and oral histories, as well as review original historic documents and photos. The museum is open 24/7 and is free of charge to all. Our thanks to the Commission for its continued assistance to the Society in helping to preserve and share the history of the SEC and the securities industry. Thanks especially to Jack Katz, Secretary of the Commission, and other staff members for helping to facilitate this roundtable. My fellow volunteer leaders and I would like to express our special appreciation to the members of the Securities Law Committee of the Federal Bar Association who have generously supported the Society's oral history activities during 2002. Thanks also to the many members of our Society who have helped to make this program and our other activities possible. If you're not currently a member of our Society and wish to join, it's easy as listening to in on this live audio stream. Please go to www.sechistorical.org, click on Join in Support, and give online by our secure and confidential server. Your much welcome contributions will help make more programs like this roundtable possible. And now, without further ado, I'll turn the program over to Kathy McGrath.
Hi. I'm going to introduce who our participants are for this afternoon's roundtable, and I'm going to do it in alphabetical order because the list I have is not the same as the seating arrangement. First, we have Barry Barbash. He's on the my far right, who was director of the Investment Management Division from 1993 to 1998. He's now at Sherman and Sterling in Washington, D.C. And a little known fact, Barry was a young snuffy in the Division of Investment Management some years before that. Next to Barry is Alan Rosenblatt. He joined the Division of Investment Management in 1964 and was there until 1976 as its chief counsel. He then moved up to the general counsel's office as an assistant general counsel for the next 10 years. And in that capacity, one of his responsibilities was keeping an eye on helping out and watching over the Division of Investment Management. Jack Dudley was in the SEC's General Counsel's Office beginning in 1958, and he was there till 1964, and then moved to be Associate Director in Investment Management from 1964 to 1968. He has been a partner with Sullivan Worcester, and I believe Jack is now retired.
Not yet.
Okay. Still there.
He's retiring.
Practicing
either.
In the investment management field. Sorry.
That's okay.
On my immediate right, and always very near and dear to my heart, because he was in the division while I was there, and it wouldn't have functioned very well without him, is Stanley Judd. He joined in 1964, and he was there for 30 years. Served as Deputy Chief Counsel and Senior Special Counsel. Since leaving the SEC, he's been a Senior Manager for PricewaterhouseCoopers and works as an independent consultant helping develop securities markets in Eastern Europe. David Silver, who is on my left, came to the SEC in 1960. To work on the investigation of the American Stock Exchange and also participated in the SEC special study and in the Division of Market Regulation, was responsible for implementing the study's stock exchange-related regulations. He was president of the key investment company industry trade association, the Investment Company Institute, from 1977 to 1991, and president of ICI Mutual Insurance from 1987 to 2000. He is a member of the Advisory Council of the SEC Historical Society and currently serves on the boards of several private organizations who are still in this business. Alan Mostoff, who is next to Dave on Dave's left, also participated in the 1963 SEC special study, then worked in the General Counsel's office and what was then called the Division of Corporate Regulation. He then was named to be the first director of the Division of Investment Management in 1972, and he did that until 1974. He's now with the Deckert Law Firm in Washington and is a member of the SEC Historical Society's Advisory Council and chairs its Investment Management Operational Committee. Next, Alan, also one over. I can't see quite. Oh, Joel, hi. Is Joel Goldberg. Joel came to the SEC in 1968 in what was then the Division of Corporate Regulation and also worked as a legal assistant to Commissioner.
No, I think
no, they've
got
Ann Jones.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Joel joined in 1973 and was division director 1981 to 83. He also was over at DOL, and he's in private practice in the investment management field with Sherman and Sterling in New York City. And now I've got the person who joined the SEC in 1968 in Corp Reg, and that's Ann Jones, who was the an assistant to Commissioner Needham and the first woman director of the Investment Management Division, a post she took in 1975, and currently serves on fund boards and corporate boards and has a wonderful perspective on this. Next to Ann is Ed O'Dell. Ed was in Trading and Exchanges, the Division of Trading and Exchanges, from 1962 to 63, and Corp Reg, 1963 to 1966, and then was engaged in practice for many years in the fund field with Goodwin and Proctor. Marty Liebecker is next to Ed O'Dell. Marty was in the Division of Investment Management 1972 to 75, and then came back again after a stint teaching, I think, from 78 to 81 as associate director. He's now with Wilmer Cutler and Pickering in D.C. And next to Marty is Paul Roy, the current division director. A little known fact about Paul is that he didn't just join the commission in November 1998 when he became director of the division, but he started out as a young snuffy in the division years before that. And in between, he was a partner at the Deckert Law Firm in Washington, D.C. And last but certainly not least is Marianne Smythe, who was in the division from 87 to 93 and served as its director from 91 to 93. She is currently with Wilmer Cutler in Washington, D.C. And that's who we are. Dave, do you want to start off with picking some history out of the brains of these old gray heads up here?
Well, thank you, Kathy. I do have to emphasize and reemphasize something that Kathy said. I am here as a ringer. My experience at the commission was with the Division of Trading and Exchanges and the Special Study of Securities Markets. My only contact back then with the then Division of Corporate Regulation involved an investigation into the New York Stock Exchange minimum commission rate schedule and how the funds allocated brokerage dollars. However, for about 35 years, I have interacted with the staff and the commission in the investment company area from my vantage point at the Investment Company Institute, and then later ICI Mutual Insurance Company. Let me say a word about the law. It was a great trepidation that I say anything about the Investment Company Act in this audience, but we are speaking for the ages, and what we say will be recorded here. I also have to say that although I regard everyone here as a good friend, there were periods in my life, had I seen all these faces at once, I would have believed I was in a terrible nightmare and hastened for the Pepto-Bismol.
And you thought this was an historical society program that we invited you to, okay?
In a way, this is the third of these panels I've been involved in, and I have to say that history is a little like the elephant. Even with the best of goodwill, it's amazing how we remember and perceive historical events very differently from one another, even assuming we remember accurately from our own point of view. So we all have also formed our own views of the law. And I guess everything here starts with the Investment Company Act on this panel. It was, of course, the last of the three major securities laws to be enacted. It's unique in several respects. It was preceded by an SEC study, a massive study conducted by the SEC, the Investment Trust Study. And I would be remiss if I didn't put one name into the historical record, and that is the leading staff member on that study, who also helped negotiate out the act with the industry in 1940, and that is David Schenker, who was a longtime dedicated staff member who was responsible on the staff level for the act. Second, the Act is the most clearly regulatory of all of the federal securities laws. In the wide range of business activities, it subjects to SEC regulation. It becomes so detailed on the corporate governance side and on the corporate side generally and the accounting side that it might be really viewed as a federal corporations law for investment companies. Finally, unlike the Securities Act or the Exchange Act, the Investment Company Act was the product of SEC industry negotiations. The final text was hammered out in 6 weeks of negotiations between representatives of the SEC, headed by, on the commission level, Commissioner Haley, and on the staff level, as I've mentioned, David Schenker. And a group of industry leaders and their counsel, most notably Alfred Juretsky of the firm of Sullivan & Cromwell and Warren Motley of the Gast & Snow firm in Boston. The underlying imperative for speedy enactment in 1940 was probably the desire of the administration to turn from economic reform to preparations for war. So in that sense, the Investment Company Act probably stands as the last piece of reform legislation coming out of that great era of the New Deal. We are not here today to discuss, and I want to make this clear, the details of the Investment Company Act or the regulatory activity under it. However, to provide a framework, and again, this is idiosyncratic on my part, I've always thought that there were about seven principles under which you can group the regulatory provisions of the Act. The first is obviously full disclosure of investment objectives, risks, fees, and costs at the time of purchase and on an ongoing basis. The second is the requirement for fair net asset calculation for incoming and retiring investors. The third is regulation of compensation paid to investment managers, distributors of fund shares, and affiliates. The fourth is prohibition of or regulation of various conflict of interest transactions. The fifth is prohibitions against unfair capital structures. The sixth is segregation and protection of fund assets. And the seventh, and something which is of continuing significance, and even more significance today, is independent director oversight of fund activities. Now, others may have other formulations, but I believe that everything we will say here today will fall under the rubric of one or more of these principles. Let me speak, since I guess I am, in a sense, the senior staff member here, having come to the commission in 1960. The modern era of investment company regulation starts with two interrelated actions taken by the commission. The first was a decision of the commission in 1958 to engage Professor Erwin Friend of the Wharton School, pursuant to the authority contained in Section 14B of the Act, to study whether the growth of the mutual fund industry to the unprecedented figure of $12 billion created any pressing public policy concerns. The second was the decision by Chairman Carey in the early 1960s to reorganize the Division of Corporate Regulation to emphasize the primary role of the division in the regulation of investment companies. Until that time, mutual fund regulation within the division was, I recall, under the supervision of an associate director who also held that title within the Division of Corporation Finance. As part of that reorganization, a branch of inspections and investigations was created in 1963. Concurrently, the responsibility for conducting investigations into violations of the Investment Company Act was transferred from the Division of Trading and Exchanges to the Division of Corporate Regulation. Ed O'Dell, who is here today, is a surviving veteran of that change, and we will hear from him about that period later. If I may end with a personal observation, it is clear to me that veterans of the Division of Corporate Regulation, under whichever name it sails, can view their work and their legacy with great pride. When the division was reorganized in 1963, mutual fund assets were about $20 billion. Today, they hover around $7 trillion. While regulation cannot force success on an industry, it can facilitate or inhibit industry growth. Inappropriate regulation can stifle growth, while wise regulatory measures, which impose and enforce high standards, can create and nurture the ever-fragile public confidence, which is the bedrock for the success of any industry composed of financial institutions. It is no accident, in my view, that there has not been a major scandal in the fund industry on the Commission's watch. The good work of the Commission in mutual fund regulation over the past 62 years also serves as a powerful and convincing refutation of those ideological theorists who lament that the securities laws prevent the crucible of the market from working its will uninhibited by government regulation. In this area, at least, it is clear that the public has been better served by regulation than otherwise. Much of the credit must go to the people sitting here today and the many others who have gone before and cannot be with us except through their legacy of achievement. Now, I'd like to start substantively with Alan Mostoff, who is the dean of regulators here today, the first division director that we had on this panel. And I'd like to ask a question involving the early days of the division and the publication of that seminal document in 1966 called Public Policy Implications of Investment Company Growth. Alan went over to the Division of Corporate Regulation after his stint in the special study in the General Counsel's office, and he worked on that 1966 report. And the study formed the basis for a comprehensive legislative program which ultimately resulted in the Investment Company Amendments Act of 1970. There were recommendations in the management fee area, sales charges, contractual plans, among many others. What, Alan, can you tell us about this major episode in the history of investment management regulation?
Thank you, Dave. I'd first like to correct the record a little bit. I was the director of what is now the Division of Investment Management from 1972 to the end of 1975, not 1974. And at that time, and I guess I can claim to be the only director of, the first and only director of the division of what was called Investment Company Regulation in 1972, and then Investment Management Regulation toward the end of 1972 and into 73, 74, and 75, and when we got around to 1976 and took over the helm, the regulation went out the window and it became the Division of Investment Management. Public policy. Well, you really set the stage for your question in your introductory remarks, Dave. Public policy began with the Wharton Report, the impetus coming from suggestions in the Wharton Report that the industry had grown to the point where there were economies of scale in the management of large pools of assets, and those economies of scale arguably were not being shared with the shareholders. That coincided with and spurred on the instigation of private litigation, claiming excessive management fees. The special study focused on an aspect of the fund industry, the selling practices and contractual plans. And all of that evolved into an agenda that the Commission formulated in developing the public policy report. The Commission was firm in its views that it would not regulate management fees, but that it wanted to have some reasonable standard for management fees, and hence the suggestion and recommendation in the report that the statute be changed to assure that the fees be reasonable. On the sales load side, the Commission wanted to control sales loads in some way to prevent them from escalating to unfettered limits. And so there were five commissioners, and each one got a point, and that resulted in a recommendation, it could be argued facetiously, that sales loads be set at 5% maximum ceiling. On the contractual plan side, the Commission sought to regulate contractual plans and control them. There were other recommendations in public policy, too, such as controlling the fund-of-funds structure. That set the stage for an intensive set of negotiations and lobbying efforts with the industry and on the Hill, by the industry and by the Commission, which ultimately resulted in the Investment Company Amendments Act of 1970, which I guess you want to lead on to.
I have a question. During your tenure, was the disclosure unit in the division shipped to Eastern Front, Corp Fin?
Yeah. Or? Well, in the beginning, when then Chairman Casey got the idea that the division should be reorganized and the commission should be reorganized, enforcement division, or the enforcement activities of the commission were split off into a separate division of enforcement, and the investment management regulatory activities were split, taken away, and consolidated. And so at first, when the division was created, it was just investment company regulation. Investment advisor regulation was moved over from the former Division of Trading and Exchanges and put into that division, which then changed its name to Investment Management Regulation. Disclosure was moved up to the Division of Corporation Finance, for where it had been originally until, I guess, it was the early 60s.
Why'd they do that? Why'd they ship it up? And then Ann got it back, I guess.
Ann got it back very necessarily in order to do her job. In order to do the job more. That's right.
Got rid of regulation and got disclosure.
In order to do the job more effectively. Well, that's not necessarily so. It could be argued that disclosure is one of the most effective regulatory techniques that the Commission has, and if it's used effectively and. I think there was such an industry concern based on experiences that the industry had dealing with the regulators who were administering disclosure through the end of the 60s and the early 70s with the regulatory impact of disclosure that the chairman was persuaded that when he was doing this, he should get disclosure back amongst the disclosure folks. And so it was moved up there for that temporary period.
Or maybe to be slightly more crude, Alan, wasn't the issue that it was perceived that where the staff didn't care for a particular proposal, but they couldn't find anything in the Ford Act that was illegal about it, they would use the disclosure process to force the registrant to comply with their views. Wasn't that essentially what the allegation was?
And that's what I mean by it being a very effective regulatory technique.
I think there may well have been another reason, which is that the tradition in corporation finance is you've got a bunch of issuers who want to make public offerings. They have underwriters champing at the bit, and the tradition in that division is get adequate disclosure and get the thing out so that industry can finance itself. And the Division of Investment Management's view was, if you have a regulatory problem, that can't be cured by disclosure, you can't let that prospectus go effective. So that there was always this tension before the consolidation and after the split, because the Division of Corporation Finance could say, well, we're making this registration statement effective because we believe there's adequate disclosure. You can deal with the regulatory problems on your own in your own way.
Now, somebody told me.
In point of fact, the reason it was given back, the disclosure was sent to CorFin, was Joel hit the nail on the head. I mean, the perception, regardless of what the staff thought, the commission thought the division was using disclosure inappropriately.
The commission thought, or the industry thought, and then the commission agreed. Yeah.
I don't.
I think Bill Casey was sold on that idea. Mm-hmm. I argued with him as mightily as I could, and the issue really came down to whether I was going to take the job as the director of the division without disclosure, or whether I was going to leave the commission. So
we're glad you
I
stayed.
To stay.
Can I ask a question?
Well, just one question. And you were the one that got it back. How did you get it back?
Well, I suppose now that enough years have passed and I no longer practice before the commission, I can be totally candid. It was a trade-off. Alan said, you know, it's a question of whether he was going to leave the commission or do it without disclosure. I said I did not want the job without disclosure because I felt it was a very important part of the function of the commission. And that's really how it came back.
I'd just like to add to this a little different viewpoint of what the staff's position may have been. In all the years I've been with the commission, I don't remember anyone ever saying there's nothing that is illegal here, but we don't like it, so we're not going to make the registration statement effective. I think the more likely position was that there was a dispute between the registrant and the staff as to whether certain activity was illegal. And in attempting to deal with that matter, there were then compromises and resolutions of those types of problems, which is probably one of the most effective and important aspects that the disclosure function plays, that these problems get ventilated at an early stage before there's any actualization of the proposal. Now, of course, people who had different opinions about the matters, they probably felt that they were being treated unfairly.
Stan, didn't you tell me that when you first came to the division, you thought that the work was organized so that you were in a branch, and it wasn't a disclosure branch, it was a branch, and it would handle the exemptive applications and the interpretations and the disclosure review for a group of registrants. The thinking being that, I don't remember what...
No, that's absolutely correct. We had a branch chief in the branch. We had a special counsel in the branch whose responsibility was to deal with the applications for exemptions and other matters by companies whose work was reviewed by the branch. And we had examiners and accountants and so on, all based within the branch. In addition to that, there was also the office that Ed was in, and Bob Broutier, and the Office of Investigation Inspections, and they also played an enforcement part.
So enforcement was separated out, and inspections were separated out, but everything else was...
Right.
Was so you really got to know that fund.
There's also general counsel, who at that time even had the no-action function.
Chief counsel, you mean? Chief counsel of the division.
Chief counsel.
So, Ann, why'd you get rid of the regulation in the name?
It seemed a better title for what we were doing with the disclosure.
It became dim.
I'm sorry?
It was dimmer, and then
it
became dim. The acronym
was dimmer.
The moment I got there. It seemed a more appropriate, and I think it was the perception, and perception becomes reality.
Yes.
The division was seen as being, by the commission, you can say it came through the industry, probably so, but by the commission, as having been too heavy-handed and too slow in a lot of interpretive positions and sort of dotting too many I's that weren't necessarily there and crossing T's that weren't necessarily there, and things took a long time to get out. And I think the desire was to still have effective regulation of the industry, but to streamline it. But I felt, as I said, that disclosure was unnecessary, and I think we all probably agree with that. Disclosure was an important part of it, but it was an attempt to make it a sort of user-friendly, user in the sense of both investors and industry.
We had planned to roughly go through the history of the division and regulation on a roughly chronological basis, but the best laid plans always give way to other exigencies. So we're going to break here and go forward 40 years or so to the tenure of Mary Ann, 30 I guess, Mary Ann Smythe as division director. It was 92, after 2 years of study, following a request of Chairman Breeden, the division published a white paper with a red cover on the state of investment company regulation with recommendations for the future. In your covering letter, you stated that the fundamental protections of the Act had worked out very well over the past 50 years. However, you also stated, and I quote, "You do recommend changes that we believe will promote investor protection, encourage innovation and flexibility, and facilitate competition and capital formation by removing unnecessary regulation." Can you give us one or two of the major recommendations? What happened, and how did they work out in practice? And then you can escape to the airport before anybody descends upon you.
Well, I don't have the reputation for answering questions immediately or directly. So first let me digress and say that I didn't write the study. Obviously, the division did. People like Matt Chambers played a tremendous role. Nancy Morris, a lot of people on the staff. That Stan Judd was always there to make sure that we didn't digress too far from historical truth. And so it was a group effort. Chairman Breeden's major contribution, in addition to insisting that the study be done, was to insist that the cover be red. He went to Stanford I went to Chapel Hill. I presented him with a Carolina blue collar. A fight ensued. He was the chairman. He won. So the Carolina Blue Book is really a red book out of an egregious power play by the chairman of the SEC. Now, what two or three recommendations did we make? I mean, the truth was that when we did the study, the more we studied, the less we were interested in recommending any changes because it was the 50th anniversary of the Investment Company Act in 1990 when we got started. And the more we looked, the more we thought that, you know, that old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And it didn't seem like it was very broke. It had worked nicely. But we had to come up with something. And the things that we came up with that I think were sensible and smart and have had some life after the study, I'd say the advertising substance of proposal, which we always thought was kind of silly to have to put into an investment company ad the substance of the big prospectus. I know that the current division has proposed a rule that essentially picks up on that idea from the study. I'm sure that it's not just from the study. There are intervening factors that made that idea have some life. The idea being that to the extent that you can simplify and make sensible those documents that investors read, you have a better chance of encouraging them to read those documents. So the advertising rule, I think, was one I would say we had. The second, we thought then, I still think now, that Congress needed to change the statute to require that investment company boards have a majority of directors who are truly independent, not just disinterested, but independent of the advisor or any affiliates of the advisor. Paul figured out a much more ingenious way than bothering Congress with this. He simply tied requirements of certain desirable deregulatory rules to an obligation that the fund have a majority of directors that are independent. I think that was very, very ingenious. And then the third thing that I'm particularly pleased with, although I don't think that everybody at this table would agree, is we recommended that a couple of things be kicked out of the Investment Company Act. Qualified investor funds, that is, funds that were invested in by rich people. We never could quite figure out how to say smart people, but in this country, money is sometimes a proxy for brains, so we said rich people. And then secondly, we recommended that asset-backed and collateralized mortgage obligation securities be exempted from the Investment Company Act. So some of our recommendations were in a direction of increasing investor protections. Others were deregulatory. And they all had a life. I could go on, but I won't.
You leave yourself open for 5 minutes of cross-discussion. So if anybody has any comments about the 92 recommendations and where they've gone, this is your chance to get Mary Ann before she races off to the airport.
You know, I have to just say, having been mostly raised in this agency and my heart still being there, in the interest of full disclosure, I just got an email from my assistant saying my flight is delayed an hour, but that I should get out to the airport.
Oh, no.
But that I should get out to the airport anyway, so I am going to be leaving very soon.
I was especially interested in Mary Ann's mentioning that when they did their study, they concluded there was very little that they really needed to change. But I remember that when I came to the commission in 1964, we believed that that the investment company was great, it was great for investor protection. And another thing that changed over time was that if something was in the Investment Company Act, even though it might seem a little bit irrational or against the grain, that it had to be good, it had to be fair. And one of the examples of that was our insistence on no quantity discounts for mutual fund sales. There had been, as Section 22D requires, that you have a fixed price disclosed in the prospectus. There had been some minor adjustments for pension plans and other kinds of arrangements, arrangements where you committed to buy a certain amount during a time. But then ultimately, we saw the light and we said, well, how about quantity discounts? And we proposed the rule to the commission. Now, Kathy McGrath wanted to go all the way and have fully negotiated prices, but I was in the general counsel's office and we told her, no, you can't repeal.
We got close. 20. We got close.
Yeah, yeah, there were
price,
many
old price made, stated in the prospectus.
You can't repeal Section 22D. You can modify it and almost repeal it, but you can't get rid of it. So
on that point, Kathy, shouldn't we give credit to Phil Loomis? Wasn't he the person who read the statute carefully enough for the first time and came up with the idea that it's not the public offering price, it's a public offering price?
You know, and that may very well be right, but I think that was a really serious mistake on the part of the division to buy that. I think it has introduced so much confusion into the industry.
Well, there is no 22D any longer.
Well, it's 12B1 that did the real damage. But anyway, I just want to and on a humorous note, which is that I think that was the only our memo to the mission had a cover. It was a blue cover, and the cover had
Blue or Carolina blue?
I don't know. It was
blue,
kind of pale blue.
It was
a Deckard blue.
Wait,
actually.
Deckard blue, attaboy.
And so we had a cartoon on the cover, and the cartoon showed a scoutmaster and some Boy Scouts in an ice cream shop. And the scoutmaster was saying, do you give any discounts for group sales? So we made our point.
Well, you know, this leads into an overall question that I have always had and that we've discussed to a certain extent, which is why has the fund industry stayed relatively clean over all these years compared to the other segments of the financial services industry, both those regulated by the SEC and banks and SNLs and insurance companies? Is it that big problems, massive scandals haven't been detected, or is there some weird combination of culture in the industry, this statute, the rules, all the cooks that have to get involved in complying with it that has made this work so that business can go on and grow while at the same time the money isn't getting stolen?
Well, a cynic might say that this is such an enormously profitable industry, you don't have to steal.
Well, that's true.
I think
so much for 36B.
I think part of it is where the fund industry sort of started, and that is sort of a trustee concept. As a Bostonian, I would point out that a lot of them started in Boston, and that we Bostonians are very proper. And I think the trustee concept carried forward, and people really felt there was a stronger fiduciary obligation to the kind of money that was put in with someone else investing it than there was if you were just buying stock. I think a lot of it is how the industry started.
But I think the statute had things built into it that encouraged
absolutely. Yes, I agree. But
I think, Kathy, Jack's point is well taken on the statute. The statute, at essence, has a number of fundamental principles that seem over time to work well as a regulatory framework. And then you add to that this ability in Section 6C to exempt out important changes or to respond to important changes in the industry. I think that combination gets you where you are, where you have a vibrant statute that works. If you go through the history of the fund business, I would venture to say that most of the significant or a number of the most significant elements of change have been facilitated by the exemptive order route. So it's the combination of the exemptive order procedure and fundamental regulatory principles that work over time. That accepts it.
You know, I think the exemptive orders and exemptive rules have a flip side, which is sometimes overlooked. Because the industry is completely dependent on the commission's use of its exemptive authority. The modern fund couldn't work without some exemptions. It really gives the commission also the ability to add whatever requirements it feels it needs to the statute simply by putting them in as a condition to an exemption. I think we saw that in the recent rules the commission adopted regarding fund governance. And whether a purist would think that's the best way to legislate or not, it certainly has allowed the commission to both expand and contract the act over the years.
Well, since we've gotten to Section 6C, I think that Marty Leibecker and Stan Judd can cast some light on where it came from and how it's been used over the years. It was, of course, until very recently that the exemptive power in the securities laws was confined to the Investment Company Act. So, Marty, why don't you kick off?
When you look at investment companies and compare the regulatory scheme to any kind of bank regulatory scheme, the first thing that surprises you is that we've got a 6C and they don't, or nothing quite like it. Certainly not a process like we've got, and there's certainly a huge benefit to having a 6C and a staff and a commission that's prepared to exercise judgment and authority. And the examples are very easy. Money market funds, where we can discuss in detail, but using 6C to basically create an exemptive relief and then ultimately to have a Rule 287. Anybody who lived through the variable annuity and variable life years knows that if without a 6C, whatever anybody says about how well insurance fits within the Act, without that authority, it would have been virtually impossible. On Kathy's watch, we had probably the first reaction that I can remember to the commission being concerned about whether it had authority with the two dissents in the Vanguard Star Fund proceeding. I remember being not the only one who got a call from Kathy saying, can you please go talk to these people, tell them what you did with money market funds, because they're not prepared to do with fund of funds. And the best part about 6E compared to what any other division's got is that if you're prepared to support what the person wants, you don't have to find some way to torture the words in Section 3C or 3A or 2 or anywhere else to make it fit, and you get the benefit when you've cited all the things that you're allowed to do in 6C by saying it's in the public interest for the protection of investors. So you can cite policy, not just law. I mean, that's the good part. The bad part is that we've all had to process applications here. I mean, when we were on the commission staff, they were filed by idiots who asked for things that were appalling. And so, and the downside is you simply can't control what people do. Yeah. And in a broader sense, it always forces regulatory change, or at least it creates the dynamics of putting regulatory change on the commission staff. Looking at the process, you've only got two choices, too, although we've all made them go from black to white. But you can support it, which often means you just negotiate forever until you finally have got something you're prepared to support. And if they get tired in the process, that's kind of their problem. Or you can tell them from the beginning you're going to oppose it. And there was a time in the late 70s and 80s when we simply sent things back and said, there's no way we'll ever support this. You know, withdraw it. Go away. But those don't give you the benefit is what I said. I think the division's always used it well to deal with things that where 6C could help create a regulatory framework where the 40 Act wasn't there. And it's made the 40 Act dynamic in the way the banking laws never were. Instead, those guys had holes punched in the Glass-Steagall Act until Congress finally made most of the Glass-Steagall Act go away with Gramm-Leach-Bliley. The bane is that other people can set your agenda, and whether you're an associate director or director, you hate it when all of a sudden you're forced to commit a whole bunch of resources to something that you'd want to have a fight about. I did it to Kathy with Stanford in requesting a hearing right in the middle of the Tia Cref application. I'm sure you didn't like spending a year and a half staffing a hearing. But
fortunately, Stan Judd was in the division. That saved the day.
Well, actually, it was the October 87 crash that did it. It became a lot less interesting to fight with TIAA-CREF after the universities were worried
but
about their...
You've got to admit that having a bunch of college professors with buckets of time on their hand harassing you daily was not fun.
They were my problem.
Well, before we stray from 6C, Dan, I think you have
never good to get her mad, Marty.
Some comments.
Several years ago, I came across an seminal essay by James M. Landis, who had served as chairman of the SEC between 1935 and 1937. The essay was published in 1938 under the title, The Administrative Process. At page 52 of that essay, I found this observation by Mr. Landis. He said, many administrators who have had to struggle with the problem of translating a statutory scheme of regulation into a working reality would have welcomed, at least in a limited form, the power conferred by the so-called Henry VIII Clause in English legislation. These celebrated clauses, he went on to say, give the administrative power to modify the provisions of legislation insofar as it may appear to be necessary to bring the scheme of regulation into effective operation. That was the first time I had ever heard of a Henry VIII clause, so I did some research to find out a little more about it. It seems that in England, a legislative clause that gives the executive power to amend the law by order in order to bring the law into effective operation or to remove any difficulty is called, perhaps in disrespectful commemoration of Henry VIII, a Henry VIII clause. Henry VIII clauses have been used to confer power to alter financial limits, to bring lists up to date, to make exceptions to the operations of a statute, or to alterations of detail within a narrowly defined field. Their use seems to date not from the age of Henry VIII, but from the Local Government Act of 1888. In his essay, Mr. Landis also had the following to say at pages 66 and 67. This is what he said. Phrases such as public interest, protection of consumers, and others abound in the law. In and of themselves, they have, of course, exactly the meaning that we put into them. But as portfolios bearing the form of a thought, they do not reach the administrative in an empty condition. Rather, they have already been lined and fitted so that it becomes impossible for the administrative to pack bricks into what is ostensibly an overnight bag. For the administrative, the task of grasping the legislative thought should not be difficult. The meaning of such expressions is, of course, derivable from the general tenor of the statute of which they are a part. To read them properly, one must catch and feel the pace of the galvanic current that sweeps through the statute as a whole. Of significance in this connection is the practice recently adopted in statutory drafting of reciting the conditions that lead to and make imperative particular legislation before setting out the provisions of the statute itself. Despite the occasional cavalier and cynical treatment of these recitals by the court, they do help to create the frame of reference within which the administrative is to operate and to pose the objective that was intended to be reached.
Stan, if I may borrow from our congressional friends, can you revise and extend your remarks for the record, or rather Dean Landis's remarks for the record?
I finished reciting Landis's remarks. I read them because I thought they were a very apt and lucid description. And to me, reading Section 6C and Section 1 of the Investment Company Act of 1940, in which the purposes, the evils that the Act was intended to eliminate or mitigate are stated, it seems more than possible to me, even likely, that they reflect the influence of the Landis essay on the drafters of the Investment Company Act of 1940.
I'll get that on in a second. They certainly may, but as I think I recall that the practice of the long introductory sections, which are contained, of course, in all of the federal securities laws and other of the New Deal legislation, was in part at least designed to show a national interest and the effects of interstate commerce and other jurisdictional provisions, which would aid the administration in the inevitable legal challenges the Supreme Court.
About the 33 Act, the 34 Act, and to some extent about the 40 Act. But the 40 Act is different in that there is stated there the evils that the Act was intended to mitigate or eliminate. And it is stated specifically that the purpose that the Act should be interpreted with that intention in mind. That is in the 40 Act. I don't believe it's in the 33 Act.
I have a very brief comment. I think that, I don't know whether the 1996 and 1998 amendments gave all the divisions
yeah.
and similar
examples. Yes. And I told Corbin not to take it.
And I'm interested, it's very interesting. I don't know to what extent they've used that power. And I recall that in earlier times when that suggestion was made, Corfin was really strongly against it. They just didn't want to be badgered by people.
Well, that's because they came up and looked at the exemptive application yeah. offices and investment management went, good God, we don't need that.
Yeah, right.
Because it may be beautiful for conforming the Act and making it work and all this stuff, but it I think consistently it has been an administrative nightmare because the resources of the division never, ever, ever match the workload that comes in through the exemptive application process.
It's been used under the 34 Act, Alan, after yeah. Gramlich Bliley and the evangelical Christian something or another yeah. filed an application under the 34 Act on its sweep vehicle to try and get exemptive relief.
Yeah. Paul, if I may ask you, I certainly think that the use that you have made out of Section 6C is surprised me, and I thought I was surprise-proof after all these years. And I don't mean that in any pejorative sense. It surprised me, and I thought it was quite an ingenious use of Section 6C. Where did the idea come from? How did it develop?
You're referring to the corporate governance effort? Well, actually, before I get started, let me make the standard disclaimer, since I still work for the commission, that these are my views, not the views of the commission. And I'll make the disclaimer for you guys, since your views probably don't represent necessarily the views of the commissioner.
No, I think they are.
Well, they should. They should.
But actually, I think a lot of people in this room who had a lot to do with the thought process on that. But actually, I think we got the idea really going back to the work that was done on 12b-1 by Joel and Joel Goldberg and Dick Grant, where in 12b-1. The concept of self-nominating directors is reflected there, and then the commission did ask for comment about the notion of independent counsel, and there were suggestions along those lines in the 12b-1 proposing and adopting releases, and you know we I guess came to the conclusion that if you could have self-nominating directors as a requirement for 12b-1. Why not a majority of independent directors? Why not encourage the notion of independent counsel for independent directors? And looking at a series of rules that involve conflicts where we thought the role of independent directors was important, that we could extend those concepts into those rules.
So I inspired this.
I think it's interesting.
Down.
It's interesting that it only took an hour to get to who it was who was responsible for 12b-1.
It's the first time I've ever heard him admit it, too.
Well, I think that we should get back to, in a sense, where Alan left off, and that is the recommendations and the 1970 amendments. But things, as I mentioned earlier, didn't start there in the history of the division. And Ed O'Dell, I would like to hear what insights you have and what memories you have as to the reorganization of the division in those early years when Chairman Carey made the determination to enhance the responsibilities of the then Division of Corporate Regulation.
Thank you, David. I came to the SEC in 1962, and I went to work in the Enforcement Division, then called Trading and Exchanges. One of the cases I worked on there involved a registered investment company, and so I had the opportunity to work with and for Sid Mendelson on that particular case. And once that case was completed, Sid was delighted to accept my offer to join him. And in those days, Sid's branch was really divided into two segments, the inspection group and the investigation group. The inspection group took on as its responsibility educating the regional offices on the fundamentals of the Investment Company Act. And that involved principally Sid and Bob Routier, with the help of some others, going around to each one of the regional offices and putting on a 2 or 3 day seminar on how the 40 Act was constructed and what its principal purposes were and so forth. They also created an inspection outline, which raised all of the various regulatory issues that regional staffs should look for. That outline happened to end up becoming the outline for Form N1R, the one of the first annual reports. Separate from that, there was an investigation group of which I was a part. And what we would do is when one of the regional offices would come upon a particularly material violation, we would go from Washington to the regional office and help them with the legal issues that they had not previously encountered. And so really, for the first time, the 40 Act enforcement was being supervised by lawyers that spent full time in the 40 Act. While it was in the Division of Trading and Exchanges, you would typically get lawyers that had never worked before on a 40 Act matter. And the statute being as complex as it is and the issues being so much different than the issues you find under either the 33 or the 34 Act, enforcement was not of the 40 Act was not a top priority. Once we started out, you would get all kinds of either basic violations on some were came close to or actually amounted to fraud. On the a common thing that you would find is that a management company would forget to renew its advisory contract on an annual basis, and you'd go in and they didn't have an effective advisory contract, and they've been collecting fees under that contract, and then you'd have to try and find out how to resolve that in a way that was fair and equitable. Some of the cases I worked on came up under the Small Business Investment Company Act, where SBICs that were regulated by the SBA were also registered under the Investment Company Act. And some very ingenious promoters found various ways to take the SBA's money in the SBIC and put it to their own use. For example, they would, on two or three different occasions, they would be in control of the SBIC. They would invest, the person controlling the SBIC would invest in a portfolio company and take the bulk of its equity, and then they would use the investment company's money to promote the venture. And usually they'd put their money in as a subordinated debt venture so that there would be no dilution of equity. We even had a case where the promoters actually put the stock of the operating companies into nominee names, either of relatives or of particular friends, and again, then use the money from the SBIC to go out and buy operating companies and in that way try to profit. So that was it was that type of thing that we found. I mean, one final example I will give you, and it happened not to be one of my cases, but one of the people that worked on the investigation unit went to a fund that was headquartered in Philadelphia, open-end fund, and it had a six-month certificate of deposit on a company called something like Consolidated Industries and Enterprises. And the investigator said, what is that company all about? And when he did, the president got flushed and concerned, and the investigator's instincts took over, and upon investigation they found out that it was a sham company, and that what the officer of the fund had done was to sell phony paper to the fund and then kept rolling it over every 6 months. And so it went from there, but it was an interesting and an exciting time, and the people in the Division of Inspection and Investigations traveled all around the country bringing some very interesting and interesting cases, and which got publicity, and I think which made the industry stand up and take heed, because the publicity was, if it ever hit you, was quite adverse. Let me stop there, David.
Well, you did mention in the course of your remarks one name, and that was of Sid Mendelson. I must say that securities regulators, like regulators of all financial institutions, usually do not invoke any affection among the people they regulate. But in the history of the division, I think there are two figures who evoked the affection and admiration of all they dealt with. And Sid Mendelson was certainly one, and Saul Friedman, of course, was the other. You used the term in describing one of your cases of finding a fair and equitable resolution in a situation in which a fund merrily went along without renewing its right to exist, in effect. And that could be used as the epitaph for both Sid and Saul. Sid and Saul were, among other things, most keenly interested in all of the work that they did and all the rules they worked on in all of the matters that came before them to find a fair and equitable result. And once Sid and Saul were convinced that the people who were before them, or the transactions that were being proposed to them, were fair and equitable, their attitude was, well, let's find a way to do it rather than find a way to block it. I did, in a memorandum to my colleagues here, one anecdote about Saul Friedman. Saul wore bowler hats. Some of you sitting here may remember that. I did know, one of the few people who knew, where he got those bowler hats.
Alfred Jaretsky of the firm of Sullivan & Cromwell, who was Saul's opposite number back in the times when the act was being negotiated, wore bowler hats, which he got in London. It would probably violate all kinds of commission rules and government regulations today, and indeed probably be felonious, that Alfred Jaretsky was the source of Saul Friedman's bowler hats. I think there are others here who remember Saul and Sid, and please, I'd like to have some of you
David, I would certainly like to second and third your comments on Sid Mendelson, who I worked much more closely with than I did with Saul. Sid Mendelson was a gentleman to the core, honest and straightforward as could be. His word was his bond. I mean, he had all the classic personality traits that a good government worker should have, and he set an outstanding example for everybody that came in contact with him, and he's missed greatly by all of his many, many friends.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Jack.
Saul Friedman, of course, was my first boss in the division, but I worked with Sid, and I felt very strongly that the enforcement that Ed and that group had was much more important, very effective, because they were familiar with the 40 Act and knew the difference between what was an important violation and what was not renewing your contract annually. What does that mean? 365 days, 12 months, and that kind of thing. So I think it was good. And Saul, my favorite Saul Friedman story was, though, we had a conference there, and Saul said, you can't do this. I think it was to Joe Levin, who used to work at the commission in the general counsel's office. That violates Section 59 of the statute. And Joe was looking down at his book to find 59, and he said, Saul, there's only 58 provisions in the Act. And Saul said, that's it. You're not going to be able to do it.
Sid was a good boss. He was mine, but it was also, he's such a genuinely nice person. It was possible to have fun with him. His wife would make, Trudy would make a sandwich for him every morning, and he would come in the car commuting with three other people, including a person who was a commissioner, who was a close personal friend of his. And because it was sitting right next to him, he couldn't much get out of the driveway without getting right into lunch. And then, of course, he'd go out for lunch. When we were at 500 North Capitol, the spiffy place to go was over at the Hyatt. It was only a couple blocks away, and we'd get Saul to go along with us Sid to go along with us every now and then. And he also was penurious. He didn't spend much on lunch. So he'd always ordered something like tuna fish sandwich, and the rest of us would always order something a little more expensive. But he always had ones in his wallet, so we would make sure that we could get his wallet out on the table when we started making change to pay the tab. And he never could figure out how his tuna fish sandwich always seemed to cost $12 to $15. And I made sure he paid the tip for all of us. He got so convinced that I was shortchanging him on the change that he brought Gokey along with a calculator one time.
I want to say about both of them that Saul and Sid, that they were the models, really, for civil servants. They were both career people. It's important to remember that. Sid started as a messenger and rose to the level of director of the division, and Saul started in the 40s as a young attorney and rose to the level of division director. They gave their entire professional career to the government and to public shareholders and public investors.
Let me say about Sid that I told you one of the conditions of my taking the job as division director. Another condition was that Sid be associate director. And Sid, it was a remarkable person because I was a little younger than Sid. I had been at the commission a lot less time. I knew a heck of a lot less than Sid knew about investment companies and regulation, but he never let that show up in any of the dealings when I was technically his boss. At least I was smart enough to know that I needed good people around me. And Saul Friedman, I had met. I was in private practice in Boston before I came to the SEC, and I had met Saul at a couple of conventions of the North American Securities Administrators, Blue Sky Regulators.
In those days, women lawyers did blue sky work, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That was one of the chief things. When I came, so I had met Saul there and then decided I wanted to work at the SEC if I could, and wound up in Saul's section. Well, I was viewed with a lot of suspicion, I think, at first, because Saul knew me and had known me under sort of social circumstances and was very friendly, and everyone looked at me sort of with the jaundiced eye because who was this person who Saul knew? But he was a terrific, just a wonderful, both of them were just superb human beings.
I told Saul Ann would never stay with the commission, should leave after getting the experience in 1 year and go back to Boston.
Well, we thought she was a industry spy.
But because Saul was such a fabulous guy, I worked under him, I really fell in love with everyone he fell in love with, and that certainly was the case with Ann. And when she went up to Commissioner Needham's office from the division, we stayed in touch. And one of the conditions for my taking the job was that Ann come down to the division as associate director.
Before we leave Sid Mendelson, I want to tell what I think is one of the funniest stories about Sid, and it was told to me by his wife Trudy. One day, Sid was home, and they were sitting at the dinner table, and one of his sons, who will go nameless, says in the middle of dinner, "Mom and Dad, I've decided to drop out of college." Sid says, "Why do you want to do that?" And his son says, "I've got to find my head." Sid stops for a moment and says, "Don't worry about it. I know just where it is."
I'll say one thing about Sidney that I'm not sure was mentioned, but I think that he had a great role in the general education of the bar and the investment company industry to the investment company law. He had a dog and pony show that he took around the country in city after city for the ALI ABA, in which he presented a series of panels on the Investment Company Act. Now, those had actually Sid started them as a form of informing the staff about the investment company.
The point you made earlier.
And from that, these other programs, which lasted for many years, took place and I believe played a real role in informing people about the act.
Yeah, and the trips he made to the regional offices was really the genesis of the Ali Aba courses that he taught later on.
David, Paul and I were baby lawyers when Sid was the director, and he was this person on high because he was the division director. We were just out of law school, and I have always thought, and I will always think of Sid as being the most knowledgeable person on everything relating to the investment company industry. He knew everything about the business. He knew everything about the people. He knew everything about the law, and he was everything everybody said. His word was bond. He just a terrific guy. He had a direct bearing on my tenure as the director of IAM. When I was a baby lawyer, I was here for about 6 or 8 months, and I got a job offer to come to New York, which I decided to take. And as a result, I left 1 week short of being with the commission staff for 1 year. I had been at the Department of Labor earlier. And I used to refer to myself as having been here for a year. And whenever I'd see Sidney, he would correct me and say, "You weren't here for a year. You weren't here for a year. You were here 1 week less than a year." So when I was the division director and I knew I was going to leave because of some testimony up on the Hill, I was able to ensure that my tenure at the commission as division director was 5 years and a week. And I went back to Sidney and I said, "Sidney, it's your damn week. Now I can say, where are you?"
And with that, I think Carl is giving me the high sign here. It's time for a break. When we return, we will, as Jerry Osheroff used to say, among other things, plumb the depths of Section 17D.
They'll never come back,
and
Dave.
That guarantees to clear the room of anybody that has any lingering affection for what we're doing up here. So we'll return here in just 15 minutes.
Thank you.
5? Okay. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit while the panelists are assembling back. Remind our listeners that there is a lot of interesting material on the website for the SEC Historical Society, www.sechistorical.org. There's a very interesting discussion of Section 17, if you can stay awake for it. And David, in the roundtable on securities regulation in the global internet economy, you raised a point as to whether the 60-year-old law, which is already plastered over with Band-Aids, is a prime candidate for a model changeover or merely requires a few more Band-Aids. And listeners can also find that discussion by clicking on the same website. Bob Posen at that same roundtable got into talking about the Section 17 debate, including a major policy question about how we want new investment management firms to be organized. And you can find that on the website as well. So anybody that's interested, it's www.sechistorical.org. Even I can punch that into the computer.
Thank you, Kathy. Resuming our trek through the history of investment management regulation, one area which in which the division has always been active is the regulation of advertising by fund organizations. Let me sort of give you the two polar examples, if you will, how things change over time. When I first came to the commission, there were staff members who knew more about type size than most printers. And I mean that quite literally. And so there was always great concern as to whether things were being disclosed in proper type size. Today, when you watch television advertising of mutual funds and other products, even drugs, in a millisecond, all kinds of disclosures flash by on the screen. In the drug area, probably what you're missing is that the most prominent side effect of this drug is death. But I challenge anyone to be able to see it. And certainly all of the stuff which the commission feels very content is being disclosed because it's in the commercial on mutual funds really is subject to the same limitations. So it's a long trek from there to here. But let's go back to the beginning, because I think we have with us the person who vetted the first mutual fund ad ever to appear on television, and that would be Jack Dudley. So, Jack, why don't you tell us about some of the early activities?
In the good old days, a lot of the ads we would review every week. We'd meet with the NASD every week and review ads, I as assistant director. And even some of these ads would go before the five commissioners and make decisions. But the one that I think Dave is referring to, there was a certain prominent fund that sponsored Lion. And the Lion wanted to walk down through New York, lower New York City. And, of course, this was what we called a tombstone ad. And as you know, tombstones can't move. So that was our first question. Can the Lion walk? Well, we passed on that and said that was okay. But then as the Lion was coming up out of the subway,
right,
there was Wall Street on top. No, you can't have Wall Street there. We objected to that. And it had.
Would you want Burger King?
About that time, I thought maybe this is my place in life at the SEC, passing on these ads.
Jack, my recollection of that was that the staff said the Lion couldn't walk up out of the subway. He had to walk down the subway.
He could walk up and he couldn't have Wall Street.
Yeah, that reminds me of a logo problem that we had. There was a fund that had a rocket
as its logo in the prospectus, and Saul Friedman said they couldn't use it unless the rocket was pointing down.
That was Harold Lease. Yeah,
but,
that's right.
But the other one, too, was the pot of gold. They had a rainbow with a pot of gold at the end, and the staff knew enough to get the pot of gold out. But we actually went to the commission and said, can they keep the rainbow shape? And the commission, in its wisdom, decided, well, if they straighten it out, they could keep the colors.
Well, by the time I came along, we had a phenomenon where every fund in the country was number one in performance in its category. It was an amazing phenomenon. And so Bob Plays and Gene Golke assembled what we used to call the A-team and tried to standardize performance numbers. And that was an incredible long process, and you know, we finally had to concede there is no right way to calculate yields and total return. We just want a way.
But in the days when I was there in the 60s, you had the statement of policy, which was very strict. You couldn't show capital gains, had to be shown separate from dividends, and it was very restrictive. And I'm sure those people are turning over in their grave if they could see some of the ads.
This discussion reflects an evolution in thought that took place throughout this time period. From the idea that the prospectus was a disclosure document to the idea that the prospectus should be a selling document. That was a major sea change.
Well, you know, another sea change was, as Jack suggested, there were very severe restrictions in showing performance at all, and they moved all the way from that to requiring it in the prospectus.
But always with that legend, past performance is no guarantee of future results.
Well, before we leave the war stories completely, I think the rocket ad was finally compromised by having the rocket go across the page, level flight. But then I remember another ad which had an oak tree, and that was decided to be improper because mighty oaks from tiny acorns grow. And therefore, the implication is that there would be growth. And I don't remember who vetoed that ad. But those were some of the...
It was perfectly logical. My recollection is that the name of the fund was the Acorn Fund.
The five commissioners sitting there deciding these issues. I think that's to be, not what they should be doing.
Well, I'd like to hear from some of you is how we went from there to here. And here is, I define, the millisecond disclosure on television. I mean, you folks were the ones that were here during all these years.
You know,
as this all developed, what happened?
I think that the single person most responsible, and he might not want to hear this, was Stan Judd. I think Stan came up with what I thought was a tremendously creative solution to a problem that had stymied the staff for years. You know, you go way back, the only ads that were allowed for mutual funds were tombstone ads. And over the years, the commission had expanded what was allowed in tombstone ads. You know, besides putting the name of the fund, you could put a brief description of the fund's investment objectives, but conceptually, a tombstone ad had to be something that was so brief it wasn't a prospectus. And the commission had already stretched the concept of what isn't a prospectus so far, it just couldn't be stretched anymore. And the big thing the industry was interested in was advertising performance, which there just wasn't any way to put that in and still think it was a tombstone ad.
The industry used to be interested in advertising performance.
Stan came up with the idea of having an omitting prospectus, what we now call a Rule 482 ad, which was a prospectus, and that's where the of the substance requirement came in. The statute says you can use an omitting prospectus that omits things that are in the full statutory prospectus. And that opened the door eventually to TV ads. I think when we first did the rules, stand, I don't think we allowed TV ads.
I'm correct. Proposed.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of factors that play together here. There's a funny kind of nature of the investment company. Think about it in comparison to any other business. What is the product of the investment company? I mean, they don't make cars that can be advertised or anything. They basically sell their shares. But the law basically said that the only way you can sort of use the means of interstate commerce in order to promote the sale of the shares was basically through a prospectus. And there was this exception to that, which was that if you had something created under Section 210 of the Securities Act, that was not a prospectus, and that was the Tombstone ad. That was not a prospectus, and therefore it was not a document that would give rise to potential liability under Section 12 of the Securities Act of 1933. But when you were thinking about how could people learn more about investment companies other than by reading the formal prospectus, and it became sort of, we were thinking, well, if we have funds that are sold through brokers, there were high sales loads, and there was the rising of the no-load funds. And some of us thought that if we could make it more possible for funds to get their messages across, that would further the no-load funds and perhaps serve to reduce loads overall. So in 1977, Sol Friedman asked me to draft a rule under the Securities Act of 1933 that would permit investment companies.
Sid Mendelson. Sid asked you to, I think.
Yeah.
You said Sol.
It couldn't be Sol.
Not in 77.
No, it was Sid, yeah.
Sid asked me to, that's what happens with memory. that would permit investment companies to include information about their past performance in their advertising. Well, as Joel mentioned, it seemed to me that Section 210 of 1933 Act, which accepts from the definition of a prospectus a notice, circular, advertisement, letter, or communication in respect of a security that does no more than identify the security, state the price thereof, state by whom orders will be executed, and contain such other information as the Commission by rules or regulations may permit, and which had already given rise to Rule 134, which permitted any investment company registered under the Investment Company Act to present extensive information about the company in an expanded tombstone advertisement, could not properly be stretched to embrace within the exception of the definition of a prospectus material that would include performance information. But in Section 10B of the 1933 Act, however, I found the basis for a rule that would permit investment companies to advertise their performance subject to appropriate restraints and in accordance with the protection of the interests of investors. That section authorizes the Commission by rule or regulation to permit, for the purposes of subsection B1 of Section 5 of the 1933 Act, in relation to any security with respect to which a registration statement under the 1933 Act has been filed, a prospectus that satisfies Section 10 of the 1933 Act. Section 10B provides that in addition to the prospectus referred to in Section 10A, that is, a prospectus that contains all of the information included in the registration statement, the Commission may permit the use of a prospectus for the purposes of subsection B1 of the Section 5, that is, to be circulated through interstate commerce, which omits in part or summarizes the information in the prospectus specified in subsection A. The Commission had already adopted a rule on summary prospectuses, which was not much used. I thought that what would do the trick would be a rule on what I called an omitting prospectus. i.e. a prospectus that was limited to information, the substance of which is included in the Section 10A prospectus, but would not have to include all of the information in the Section 10A prospectus. Such a prospectus would expose a person using it to sell a security by the means of interstate commerce to liability under Section 12(2) of the 1933 Act if the prospectus was untrue or materially misleading. That's different from the 134 Act. In addition, such a prospectus, while not itself subject to Section 11 of the 1933 Act, would be limited to information, the substance of which is included in the Section 10A prospectus, and thus to information whose substance is subject to liability under Section 11. Now, Section 11 liability is quite different than Section 12(2) liability in terms of the people who are liable. Under Section 12(2), under Section 11, that liability would potentially extend to, among others, one, every person who signed the registration statement, two, every director of the issuer, three, accountants who have consented to be named as having prepared or certified any part of the registration, or as having prepared or certified a report or valuation which is used in connection with the registration, and every underwriter with respect to such security.
Stan, I think at that point you talk about the potential liabilities which can flow from misleading and inaccurate advertising. Let me cut to Barry, who is the most recent division director we have present right now, and ask him, has, in effect, during your tenure, has these restraints on advertising had any real effect? And second, during your tenure, did the commission contemplate, or did they bring any actions based on false and misleading ads as the gravamen of the defense, of the offense?
Answering the second question first, I don't recall during my five-year tenure, David, that we brought cases on advertising. There have been some cases brought since, but I believe there weren't any at that point in time. In terms of the approach towards 482 or what should be done with 482, Mary Ann mentioned earlier that during the course of doing the Red Book study, the issue came up of the substance of requirement embedded in 482, which for many participants in the fund business became something of an administrative nightmare. And the question there was, is everything in a prospectus, does everything in a prospectus, if you put out a particular ad, does the ad have to be limited to just every word has to be limited to what's in the prospectus? So, for example, the ad type of the problem in the ad that people would note was you have an advertisement you want to put out about a fund that invests in Japanese securities. Can you put out an ad that talked a little bit about the Japanese market? And the question was, well, gee, if you did that, would that be not consistent with the substance of requirement? Because if there was nothing about Japan in the prospectus or the statement of additional information, then how could you do the ad? And a number of people in the fund business were talking about being whipsawed on ads and not being able to have ads that talked about information that really didn't address the fund particularly, but information about the kinds of securities. And that had been picked up in the Red Book study as something that probably should be taken into account to modernize advertisements and get away from the idea that every ad had to mirror what was in the prospectus, get away from that concept and broaden out the information. That's where we were heading during the tenure. It's really been during Paul's tenure that the staff has made more progress in getting out a rule proposal on that subject. During my time, things were really quiet on the advertising front generally, probably because most of the time and attention we were spending in the disclosure area was on the prospectus itself and trying to simplify it.
What role did the NESD play during your tenure, of course, historically being very active in this area?
Well, the NESD continued its role of looking at advertisements. Generally, during the time that I was a division director in the advertisement area, where the largest issue was the issue of manager performance and portfolio managers and their results over time, and portfolio managers moving from a particular fund group where they developed a record of performance, wanting to go over to a new organization and wanting to bring the performance record with them. And we were faced on the staff with the question of whether doing that was consistent with the securities laws or precluded by the securities laws. And I would argue that it's pretty clear under the securities laws that are applicable here that moving performance records, so long as there's clear disclosure of what the role was of the portfolio manager and other material information about what that portfolio manager did and what his or her record was, that you could move it. It was not an issue under the securities laws. The NESD saw it differently, and the NESD members thought that there was still a possibility for misleading information about having track records following, and most of the time during my tenure, it was a debate about that particular subject. That was the issue of advertising.
Well, the SEC has actually delegated virtually all of the responsibility for review of advertising of mutual funds to the NASD. So one might ask them why you see television ads where you can't read the stuff that you have to put in a 482 ad.
That's because you're as old as I am. You can't read it. That's why you can't read it.
I think it's just advancing age, Alan.
Yeah, that's right.
That we can't read those millisecond disclaimers.
No, but I've had some dealings with the NASD on various issues, and they are very strict on print stuff. I mean, they can drive you crazy on print stuff. But the television area seems to be they seem to be letting it all go.
They're good on print stuff. You ought to see them on quill pens. They're really absolutely terrific.
Are you going to get after Joe Goldberg and get an explanation here of 12b-1?
A complete explanation of 12b-1. But let's pick up first where Alan left off. He sort of got off the hook early because Marianne had to leave. Alan, there were a whole series of recommendations in the public policy report. They were in the sales area, sales loads specifically. They were in the management fee area. They were in the contractual plan area. Of those three major groups of recommendations, the contractual plan problem seems to at least been solved by the 70 amendments, which changed the structure of contractual plans without getting into what the old front-end load was and all the rest of it. Really doesn't seem to be a live problem today. The one that's open continuously and was opened in 1970 was the management fee area. There was immediate litigation on the private side claiming fees were excessive under Section 36B. But there is, we should get to that, but there is one curiosity about the Act, about Section 36B specifically, that I think I mentioned to some of you at lunch today. In the negotiations which led to the enactment of the 70 amendments, the Commission staff was very firm on insisting that the Commission have a right to sue on its own, that Section 36B should not be left wholly to private enforcement, but that the Commission could bring a case quite independently under Section 36B in the case of excessive fees. And this was a major bone of contention
in the negotiations. And finally, the commission prevailed, and the commission does have the right to bring an action for excessive fees under Section 36B. From that day in 1970 to today, the commission has never brought an action under Section 36B alleging excessive fees. Does anybody here have any expectation?
Must be reasonable, those fees.
Excessive fees, I guess. Yeah, one way to look at this is that the statute, and as enhanced in 1970, has worked reasonably well. And with the increasing intensity of independent directors in the performance of their duties, generally that fees have been kept under control enough so that there's not a situation that's come to the commission's attention, presumably, that is shocking enough to warrant commission taking the initiative and bringing an enforcement action or legal action.
As an independent director, I hope that the fund publications who are here present today will quote you accurately and distinctly and fully.
What can I say?
Well, you know, the fees also have stayed across the industry within a certain close range of one another, and so if the commission were to sue them, they have to sue them all.
Yeah, there's one oddity.
Also, you know, if you look at the court, let me just finish your thought here. If you look at the tests of reasonableness that as they've been articulated by the courts, a lot depends upon the concept of profitability, and profitability gets you into the question of whether you penalize someone who's running an efficient business and therefore enhancing his the profitability because of the efficiency of the company. And I think it takes you around in a circle. So it does seem to me that the statute is working, and it's reasonable to presume, absent a commission action, that nothing has come to the commission staff's attention that warrants bringing and initiating an independent challenge to a set of advisory fees.
Alan said around in a circle.
Well, one oddity of Section 36B is that it says that the investment advisor has a fiduciary duty with respect to the fees. But the case law, as it developed very quickly, focused on although there was some attention given to profitability, they're focused on what the directors did, whether they were fully informed, and whether they considered the appropriate factors. They felt that the advisory fee was reasonable, not that anybody else did. So that's if you look at the case, and you know, we have Deckard has a lot of investment company clients, but I have to tell you, and it's all in the cases, when you look at the profitability figures in at least several of the cases, the profitability is rather high. And the court said, well, no, the directors, you know, felt that was okay, and they were fully informed, so that was so that means that there's no violation of Section 36B.
Well, you know, I think Alan, both you and Alan Mostoff have kind of equated a highly profitable fee with a potentially excessive fee, and I don't think that's what the courts have said. I think they've said profitability is one of several factors that you consider.
I certainly didn't mean to create that implication. My point is that I'm not sure that profitability is a factor that you should consider, because a dramatically profitable company could be profitable as a result of the operating efficiencies of management, as opposed to the unreasonableness of the advisory fee.
If you go back to the legislative history of 36B, I think what you have is these days what the statute was intending to get at. When the 66 public policy implications study came out, that asked for or recommended a substantive reasonableness standard, that somebody make a finding that this particular fee is excessive. And what happened through the negotiation process is you got a standard written into 36B that is generally process-oriented, I would argue correctly interpreted by the courts to be process-oriented, and the result is that in a process-oriented context, it's very hard to challenge the fee if the process is followed. This is an industry that pays close attention to the process, and I think there was the reason why the SEC hasn't been able to bring or hasn't brought cases over time is simply that. The process is well developed. It's talked about all the time in court cases. It's talked about at every conference, and most of the people in the industry get it right. And it would be very hard, given the way the court cases have come out, for the SEC to bring a case. And since the commission is always under resource constraints in all of its areas, particularly in the enforcement area, to bring a mega case and lose it is worse than anything. And I think there's been a reluctance. Clearly, that's what we felt during my tenure.
I would like to irreverently suggest, however, and I include myself in this comment, that if any one of us, if all of us, were sitting on a panel as commission employees 15 years ago, this would be a very different discussion of whether management fees are too high or not too high. I think it depends sort of, frankly, where you sit.
The last point I'd make, I don't mean this to be the last point that's made about this, but the point I'd like to make is if you look at the litigated cases, the ones that have been actually where you've got either district court or an appellate opinion, I think we're talking less than 10. If I'm not wrong, 7 or 8 of the 10 are money market funds. The last one was a bond fund, and the process in that last case was by far the worst of all of the processes that were carried on. Think about it, and there's always a suggestion that money market funds, that they become more profitable as there's more money under management, and there have to be breakpoints. The original case against Gartenberg, the breakpoint, if I'm not wrong, is at $1 billion, and it's never been changed. There's one breakpoint. That's it. From the time they put it in place to the time they got sued in that lawsuit till today, there's one breakpoint, same place. Okay, Rosenblatt opens an account at a brokerage firm, and he puts $1,000 into a money market fund, and let's just say it's got 100 basis point expense ratio. So he pays $10 for his $1,000, and he gets all the services that they're supposed to get, all of them. Barbash, of course, is much more highly compensated, so he puts his $100,000 in the same brokerage firm and in the same money market fund, and he pays a whole lot more for exactly the same services. If what was intended to be attacked under 36B was the idea that small shareholders shouldn't subsidize large shareholders, the reality is it's exactly the other way around. Large shareholders and money market funds subsidize small shareholders, and so what we're seeing today is the leakage back out of money market funds into bank deposit accounts, where small shareholders who end up in the deposit account can be charged at the account level an amount of money that supports the services they're actually receiving. I don't think there's anything wrong with the way things are today. I didn't mean to
see that. Just proves that 15 years on, we're all much wiser.
Yeah. Helps to help the facts.
Maybe that's it.
So can we get Joel to tell us about 12B1?
Yeah. Before we get to that, Joel, because the first great debate about 12B1, as I recall, took place in a room between Alan Rosenblatt and myself. It had been the industry's position from time immemorial that the Investment Company Act did not preclude a fund from using its own assets to promote the sale of fund shares. One can argue ad infinitum about the utility of that position on both sides, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. But the first argument, I think, was purely the legal argument that there was no prohibition in the Act against the fund using its own assets for distribution. Alan, what was your position?
Well, I don't remember our speaking about this, but I think the way it came out, and that's why it's in 12B, it's a 12B rule, is that the 12B says you can't act as a fund can act as an underwriter of securities, except under rules adopted by the commission. So that's why, and 12b-1 says you can, in effect, act as an underwriter of your own shares if you meet these conditions. Now, whether the conditions really are realistic anymore is another question, and whether there should have been some cap on the amount you could charge, and whether you could charge a sales load and a 12b-1 fee, which I would have thought was not the case when it was proposed or adopted, is another question, too.
Well, we can conduct second round 20 years later of that legal debate, because the bearing of Section 10 is very important. But that does set the stage for Joel explaining to us everything he knows about 12b-1, when and how, the circumstances under which it was adopted. We do have to go back to the time when the open-end segment of the mutual fund industry was in dire straits. The industry was in net redemptions for a period. Nobody thinks that's a good or healthy condition for shareholders who remain. And the industry was looking for a source of funds to finance distribution. And Joel, how did you come into the act?
Well, without entering into the question of who was responsible for the rule, I will admit to being near the scene of the accident. I think that a couple of myths have to be punctured right from the start. Everyone talks about Rule 12b-1 as being the rule that permits funds to pay for distribution. It isn't. For years, as Alan and Dave have suggested, the commission and the staff took the position that mutual funds shouldn't pay for distribution, that there was an unacceptable conflict of interest. But they never could quite find a section of the act saying that. And there were various theories advanced. You know, it was a per se breach of fiduciary duty, or it was a 17D, or, you know, or if there was a sharing of the advisory fee, it was an assignment of the advisory contract. But none of these theories really stood up to an analysis. But it was kind of like the elephant in the living room. Nobody really wanted to say that there wasn't anything illegal about funds paying for distribution until the pressure to increase sales became so great that some in the industry effectively challenged the commission's position. You had several money funds organized where they were saying in their prospectus that they would share half of the advisory fee with dealers who sold their shares. And obviously, it's a very small step from that to saying, well, we'll just only charge half the advisory fee, and we'll have the fund pay what would have been the other half directly to the salesperson. It had become clear that the sort of in terrorem statements about it being generally inappropriate or immoral to pay for distribution were not going to hold back the tide forever. And I think that's what prompted the commission, or at least the staff, to recommend to the commission that they regularize and limit the practice. That was done, as Alan suggests, by adopting a rule under Section 12B of the Act. The commission defined the term acting as your own underwriter to include paying for distribution. So if you pay for distribution, you're acting as your own underwriter. Section 12B says you can't do that in contravention of commission rules. There had been no commission rules until then, but the commission adopted one, and it restricted the circumstances under which a fund could pay for distribution. So I think the first myth is that Rule 12b1 allows funds to pay for distribution. The second myth is that it was in response to the net redemptions that were prevalent in the industry, and that there was sort of a desperation attached to it. In fact, by the time the rule was adopted in 1980, the money funds had brought the industry back to unprecedented prosperity, and there were even increasing sales of equity funds. The net redemptions had ended years earlier. The real impetus for adopting Rule 12b1 was the fact that the lack of any intellectual basis for preventing payments for distribution had surfaced, and to mix the metaphors, you couldn't get the genie back into the bottle. Now, I think if I had it to do over again, or even if I had it to do the first time, I think the big mistake the staff and the commission made at the time of Rule 12b1 was we did not foresee that payments out of fund assets would be used as a substitute for a sales load.
Right.
And when in the form of a contingent deferred sales charge. And when you think about it, it was so obvious, it's just astounding that we never thought about it, because the insurance industry had been doing essentially the same thing for years by having contingent deferred sales charges on variable annuity contracts, and then using the mortality and expense charge to cover that. It's astonishing that we never thought that could be about the fact that could be easily transferred to the conventional fund industry.
On your point about, and David mentioned it, about the assignment of the advisory fee, there's actually a no action letter that I wrote that said that, where they said we wanted to share our advisory fee with the broker deal, and they said that was an assignment. And there's a subsequent letter signed by Joel Goldberg that said, when somebody wrote in again, said, no, don't worry about that, we're thinking about it.
Well, we were.
Talking about intellectual basis, I think there's nothing wrong with saying that it's an assignment of the advisory fee. If you look at the definition of assignment, it's includes assignment of a chosen action, which is the right to receive proceeds.
Joel's history is
give it up, Alan.
Well,
Joel's history is
I recall Sid Mendelson explaining 12b1 when it was done as just putting on top of the table what was being done under the
exactly.
table.
Exactly. Joel's history is more than fair. We had such problems.
Except you're going to want to go back a little bit further, because I remember in the middle 70s when the industry was in net redemption, being visited by fund representatives. I remember an appearance that a former chairman made before the commission pleading the poverty of the fund industry, and I remember commissioners at the conclusion of that saying, to me as the division director, we've got to do something, and the staff began thinking about it.
But you can follow the record. It's very clear the staff went to the commission on a number over a period of years, almost 5 years, and constantly asked either to sue the people who were breaching the commission's unwritten rule or to do something, and putting it on a table, I absolutely was right next to you when that decision was being made. It was right.
Oh,
we had,
so it was you?
No, Grant, it's Dick Grant who did it. It's Grant. But what we had, the money market fund example that was the worst, we could not get Commissioner Pollack to see his way clear to an enforcement case, was the one where the unnamed investment advisor for 10 basis points would advise the fund. Regional broker dealers, unnamed, would have Class A, B, C, D, E shares in the two, in the advisor that was beformed. Dividends paid on Class A would be exactly equal to 20 basis points in every damn dollar you put, you know, the broker put in the fund. How could you not say that that was using fund assets to pay for distribution? We either wanted to sue them or we had to do something. And the intellectual record is that there were three or four commissioners who absolutely wanted to stick with you can't use fund assets for distribution. And this, I absolutely agree with Joel. It's very fair on the history of how it happened. And I will also agree that none of us foresaw that you get level loads. It wasn't on the list.
Well, if I can just finish up on the thought of the level loads, I think that's the great flaw in 12b1 as it exists, because the rule really assumed, you know, you'd have, you know, a payment of maybe 20 points, 25 points tops, and it would cover advertising or, you know, training of sales personnel or that kind of thing. So the requirements of the rule make absolutely no sense in the context of contingent deferred sales loads, especially the requirement that the plan can't continue for more than a year at a time, and it can be terminated any time. I think that all of these underwriters who have advanced millions of dollars for payments of sales commissions would be quite surprised to be told that there isn't any assurance they're going to get the money back.
How about
through
the
a
folks
12B1.
Who securitized them?
Well, yeah.
They get a guarantee from the advisor.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Joel, you talk about what you think the big mistake was or the oversight was in 12B1. And my recollection is, just as an aside, that it was an Alan Mostoff client that had
it certainly was
contingent deferred sales charge. I remember,
and it didn't do that. It couldn't do that without the exemptive order that the we were able to obtain upon persuasion.
Annuity. And I was a young practitioner, and we were all astounded at the step that was taken. We never thought
seemed perfectly
that
natural.
That was where 12B1 was going to go. But I once had occasion, I had Sidney Mendelson, who was the division director then when 12B1 was adopted. Sidney was a division director. Joel was an associate director. Dick Grant was, I think, special counsel to Sidney. Marty was an associate director. All of them had something to do with this project. I can tell you I was there. And Dick used to make me, I was a young staff attorney, Dick used to make me drive him out to his house in Arlington, and as I lived out that way, and he was complaining the whole time about it. So in the name of Dick, I would say he didn't like it either. But I once asked Sidney, in the context of having him come over and talk to the staff about various issues, I asked him what did he think of 12B1, and he was totally convinced it was the right thing to do. He always agreed that there was no legal basis he could see in the 40 Act that said that you couldn't have distribution payments made out of fund assets. But interestingly, the thing that he was always troubled by was that there was no cap on 12B1 payments.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one.
I think that the reason there can't be a cap, I don't think there can ever be one. And the reason there
can't... Tell the NESD that?
What?
You tell the NESD that?
That's a bucket, not a cap.
Well, no. The reason there can't be a cap on the charge to the fund, I think, is this. Before the commission permitted, if you will, fund assets to be used for distribution, there were no load funds, and they used to sell through advertising. They obviously had some contribution expenses. Even the load funds would operate at a loss as far as the underwriter was concerned. Typically, the distribution for load funds cost more than the sales load would compensate for. Who paid for this? Who paid for the distribution of the no-load funds or for the load funds? The answer was the investment advisor. Well, where'd the investment advisor get the money? Ding, 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 from the fund.
Through the advisory fee, you mean?
Right.
Yes.
And I think if you say, all right, the 12B1 fee can't exceed, I don't know, 50 points, do you prevent the investment advisor from kicking in another 50? And if you have you outlawed no load funds?
Can I just, isn't it not the government's point position and the best position to set caps on what's happening in the marketplace? Hasn't the industry really set the caps? And hasn't that answer the question why there's no suits under 36B and why 12B1, the cap is about to 1%?
I think that's right.
I mean, the government does a bad job, but they get involved in setting prices.
You're absolutely right, but 12B1 has led to a situation where today people are confused and find it somewhat awkward to deal with the constraints of the rule and the business constraints that they find themselves in as a result of taking advantage of the rule. But I want to speak on behalf of the rule for a minute. Without the changes in 12B that resulted in 12B1, and also without the contingent deferred sales charge, there would not have been, in my view, an embracing by the retail brokerage industry of the mutual fund concept. And I don't think they would have distributed mutual funds the way they ultimately have. And I don't think mutual funds, which I believe are a wonderful product, would have been embraced by the public investor the way it has. 12B1 has allowed that to happen. Now, that's not to say that there isn't room for improvement in the current situation, but it allowed and caused, I believe, a sea change in the attitudes toward mutual funds as a form of investment that the retail industry was willing to merchandise.
I was intrigued to see that the commission indicated maybe an interest in looking at 12B1. And, without going into it in any great depth, I would hope they would. I doubt that it's going to happen anytime soon, but I would hope they would. I remember because a precursor of 12B1 was on the table when I was director, and one of the ugliest meetings I ever attended, commission staff, was between investment management and enforcement over 12B1. I mean, the commission was always a very wonderful place to work and great relationships between all of the divisions. And I want to tell you that this one meeting with enforcement practically accusing us of being criminals, it was the ugliest meeting, I think maybe the ugliest meeting of staff I have ever attended at any agency, and I've been at two others, as you know. It sticks with me, but I was happy to leave before 12B1 was adopted. My hands are clean.
I just say that the concept of, as you mentioned, and this sort of coming out of the trust and Boston and so on, I think is very significant in creating the idea that the purpose of these funds are to serve the interests of the participants, and that their interest is in the growth of their investments and return, and that they are not particularly interested in the business aspect of the growth of the fund if there is no, for example, growth in the net asset value per share. Now, Mike, I've done some work in the last 9 years around the world, And I must say that I don't think I've ever occasioned come across any place a concept of funds bearing sales distribution costs.
Well, Stan, I think I'll exercise my prerogative of closing this part of the discussion with a very quick anecdote. I was privileged to have in one of his later years in teaching the law of trusts, Professor Scott, who some of you probably have heard of. And on the question of who pays who for what, Professor Scott dealt with that. And he said that in the typical Boston situation, the husband goes to his reward, the widow goes to Europe, and has the grand tour, does the opera, sees the Mona Lisa, comes back on the Mauritania, or whatever it is, that docks in Boston. And there is a young man from the Harvard Trust Company waiting on the dock with flowers, etc. And at that point, Professor Scott would lean forward over the glasses and say, "Who do you think was paying for those flowers?" So it really is the same question that always exists. Ultimately, of course, it's the customer who pays.
But which customer, Dave?
Well, who paid the widow's for the widow's flowers?
She did, but the 12B1 fees.
The other shareholders who came in before they started paying the 12B1 fees, they pay.
Well, I think we're at a point where I want to give each of you really a very short period. There are a lot of us here who say a minute, 2 minutes at most, on sort of the triumph and tragedies. What do you regard as the greatest positive event in the time, your time, at the on the staff? What do you think is an opportunity that was foregone that should have been done? And although you're the most recent, Barry, you happen to be sitting there. So let's start with you and go around the table.
I look back fondly. I think the thing that strikes me about having worked in this building is having worked in this building. I look back on every day as a terrific experience, and I just enjoyed the 5 years immensely here. In terms of substantive matters, a lot of our time during my tenure was spent on disclosure and trying to make the prospectus easier to use, more understandable for investors. And I have to say, looking back, it reminds me something of Don Quixote. I'm not sure you can ever win that one. I think you go out and you try to get prospectuses to be somewhat simpler. I think it's in the interest of shareholders that they are, but inevitably someone else is going to have to do it 5 years down the road or 6 years down the road, because I think there's a tension with disclosure, and it's a continuum between wanting materials that are understandable and useful and then using disclosure as a means to affect some kind of regulatory purpose. And inevitably, when you're trying to engage in the latter endeavor of trying to affect a regulatory purpose, you end up with documents that are really not understandable. They're not designed to be understandable. They're designed to regulate. So as I look back, I'm glad we tried to simplify the prospectus. I wish it would had been longer standing. In terms of what I regret not having the opportunity, going back to a theme from earlier, I would have liked, and it just didn't come up that there was anything at the time, I was always amazed at what the division staff did in the money market area and facilitate a product or service, whatever you want to call it, that was so different, so beneficial. I regret not having the opportunity of having worked on something of that sort. It just didn't come up that we worked on that. We tended over my 5 years to work on other themes, and we didn't have an opportunity to do something like that. And I admire the staff who did.
Alan Rosenblatt.
I think by far the thing I remember as the most, had the most fun on and found most rewarding was the 70 amendments, which I think we've covered adequately. But I think a close second is the so-called mini-account rule, which is the basis for the RAPFI accounts, which have grown enormously. And that has a curious history because we saw ads in the paper and other media of investment advisors who were managing small accounts as low as $5,000 and supposedly gave personalized service. And we couldn't believe that that could be the case. And we tried to stop it with some warnings and no action letters, and William Casey thought that was wrong, and he said to Alan Mossoff, you know, get rid of that, stop it. There's no reason why you can't bunch customers and have their funds managed on this sort of basis. And Alan came up with a very original and innovative idea, which is let's have an advisory committee. Now, happily, the Advisory Committee Act had been adopted, but it was not yet effective. Otherwise, we couldn't have done this in such a short time because we would have had a charter approved by the commission. All meetings would have had to have been open. So we got all the foxes into the chicken coop. We got Merrill Lynch, who had been doing something similar. We got Debevoise, who had represented Citibank when they did their when they advertised something that was like a managing agency account or a common trust fund, but it was a very small account. And when the commission looked at it, they found there were really only 8 securities they ever invested in. So they sued Citibank, and there was a settlement in which Citibank agreed, you know, to mend its ways. Well, the interesting thing about the advisory committee was the people on it were really terrific. We found out that that one of the main offenders, a guy named Danforth, we thought was the main offender, who was advertising $5,000 accounts. We went up to Connecticut and went to his office and found he was actually doing it and giving individualized service. And the advisory committee was very useful because they really believed that they could help work out a regulatory scheme to deal with this, and there were some which were ultimately adopted as Rule 3A4, which says you can run parallel trades, you can bunch people's money, you can pool people's money. It won't be an unregistered investment company, just so long as some basic principles are followed, including the ability to instruct the advisor not to invest in certain types of securities, and also the ability to take your assets out in whole or in part at any time, which you cannot do with an investment company. So I think that worked pretty well, and that set the stage for the RAPFI accounts that are very common now.
In a couple of sentences, greatest tragedy.
The greatest tragedy was losing the low case, and that was a case in which we went after a really bad guy who had been whose advisory registration had been revoked by the commission because among other things, he made misrepresentations to a court. He had stolen money from his clients, and then when he settled the case, he had falsified a check that he had taken a check for $1,000 and changed it to $10,000 and presented as evidence in the court that he had settled the case. And so we went after him and tried to enjoin his acting as an advisor. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that the Advisors Act does not cover newsletters that do not give personal advice tailored to the individual needs of the client. That completely deregulated a whole segment of the industry that we had been regulating for years and thought that we had the right to regulate. Interestingly enough, the dissenters in the case said, no, the commission is right, but this statute is unconstitutional.
I remember arguing with Bob Locke that at some point the First Amendment does trump the Advisors Act. Jack Dudley, triumph and tragedy.
Dave, I look back and being an assistant director, associate director of the division, and as a government employee, I just thought it was my responsibility to treat people fairly that came before the commission and not to abuse the power that a government person has. So it was a simpler time. There didn't seem to be any great issues. As a personal triumph, I think it was appearing before the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit upholding Rule 17D1, on the promise that the commission would revise the rule, and it wouldn't be as complicated as it now appeared, as I promised Judge Friendly. My biggest failure, you know what it was, I never could convince the commission to change Rule 17D1. I still have a solution.
Stanley, triumph and tragedy.
I just say that I enjoyed the almost 30 years that I was at the commission. There was a lot of interesting things that developed on a day-by-day basis, and I'm not prepared to say which child is the most beautiful. In terms of...
The most ugly.
In terms of... But what, all I can say is that as you age, you continually discover things, and you find out things that you did may not have been as wise as you thought they were when you did them. For example, there was a request once that came in for a no-action position with regard to the situation where you had a person abroad who was sold an interest in a foreign investment company who had a brokerage account in the United States, and the sales efforts to sell the fund was made from abroad to where this person lived, and there was no connection with the United States except that the instruction would go to his brokerage account in the United States to pay for the sale of the mutual fund. And I wrote that we would not, in that circumstance, see that that this was a sale through jurisdictional means of the sale of the mutual fund share. Well, last spring, I was in Panama, and I find that in Panama, they have sort of, and I suppose throughout the rest of the Caribbean, they have taken this as the way in which to sell sort of funds patented after American funds, but they are not American funds, but they are sold as like American funds. They are usually promoted by people who come down from Miami, from what I've heard, good-looking women who give lectures on them. The securities are then...
I don't know which side you're coming out on, Stanley.
SEC versus good-looking women. Well, I can see it now.
The point is that the result of this is that you have people in that whole area who think they're buying American funds, but what they're doing basically is buying a foreign fund, which is the way it's being sold, the only connection being with a payment coming out of a United States broker's account, that in those circumstances, there is none of the protections that we think of as applying, that is, the Investment Company Act doesn't apply, the 33 Act doesn't apply, nothing applies, and these people all over the world nevertheless are putting their confidence in these types of securities.
What about Regulation S?
Kathy, you don't get off the hook because you're a moderator.
Okay.
Triumph, greatest tragedy.
I guess the rule that I liked the best was the fee table. But I think the thing that I liked the best was the fact that in the 7 years that I was at the division, it got to be a very popular and happy place to work with everybody producing a lot of stuff. And I think we had real high morale and a good time and managed to get a fair amount of quality work done. My biggest failure, I think, was... trying to tackle and clean up Rule 12b-1 and see if we could get the findings that the directors had to make straight and CDSCs. So we did get the NASD, I guess, by scaring the hell out of the industry to come up with their buckets rule, but that was a hard lesson. There was too much money flowing through 12b-1 fees to make it touchable.
Alan?
Well, I had the same experience that others have had. I had a terrific career.
really had a lot of professional gratification from the 8 years or so that I was in the division as a special counsel, assistant director, associate director, and then director. I was privileged to work with people who had institutional memory that went back to the 1940. So I learned from them and was able to work with them in some of the changes that led to the public policy, changes in view that led to the public policy report, and the 70 amendments were an exciting time for me, and the 75 amendments were very exciting. Clarifying the Commission's position on insurance products to the extent one could, and with variable annuities and variable life, was a challenge for the division that I thought we did a reasonably good job with the assistance of the General Counsel in dealing with. While it was over by the time I became the division director, a good part of my career in the division was spent giving some attention to the problem of unregistered funds, Stanley, in the context of the fund of funds, which was a real live demonstration in the 60s of the wisdom of 1940 that led to the enactment of a statute that is intended to protect investors in a pool vehicle from the kinds of abuses that went on in the 30s, because we found them again in the context of the fund of funds. Disappointments. I'm not sure it qualifies as a disappointment, but it was really a strange situation, which I thought you might have wanted to talk about. The position of the Commission with respect to the fiduciary, I thought you might be leading into this when you talked about Mr. Scott. The question of the fiduciary obligation or responsibility of the investment advisor with respect to the company he or she is managing in the context of the transfer of control of that company. That was a problem that the Commission has wrestled with, as we know, for ages, going back to the ISI case. And as a young lawyer, when I joined the division in 64, I got a big lecture about the importance of the Commission finding the right case to reverse that decision. And I spent a lot of time finding the right case, and when we thought we had the right case, we went up to the Commission. And lo and behold, the Commission didn't want to reverse the decision.
We had the right cases, but the Commission didn't want to bring
it. Right. And that turned around into public policy, where the Commission said that on the one hand, there is a fiduciary obligation, but on the other hand, the advisor should be compensated for the entrepreneurial efforts and wisdom. And then all of a sudden, we had Judge Friendly and the Rosenfeld v. Black case giving the Commission what it wanted in the ISI case, and Casey calling me into his office and saying, we've got to do something about this. Let's get this reversed. This was the position the Commission wanted. And that led to Section 15F and the 75 amendments, which was amazing.
Just something real quick. They came in at that point. Lazard came in to us and said, we want to have this ability that we will not compete. And that's what we're selling. And at that point, the Commission had given up on bringing the perfect case, and we let them walk out of the office. And then and the private lawsuit did what they were asking the staff to do all along.
Now, one other thing. I was really a convert to the concept of regulation and as a important vehicle for the protection of investors. And when I started to look at the Investment Advisors Act, I felt that it was a sort of an empty vessel, and I wanted to see the Commission do more there. And we did work on the concept of an expansion of the Advisors Act to build into it some minimum qualifications for investment advisor activity. There was a legislative proposal which was hatched, I guess, while I was the director of the division, and of course that went nowhere. But that might qualify as a disappointment.
Joel?
Well, I guess in terms of the one of the things I was the most proud of was probably a negative accomplishment. A fund was filed during my time as director that was going to be sponsored by Visa International. And this was at the time that the banks still weren't allowed to sponsor funds. Visa filed a money fund that they proposed would be sold through banks that were members of Visa International. And what was unique about the fund was it would invest in CDs issued by the banks that sold the fund in approximate proportion to the amount of shares that the banks sold. And there was enormous pressure from both inside and outside the commission to make this fund effective. They weren't asking for any kind of exemptive order. They wanted only to be made effective. And this was sort of the heyday of the Reagan years. And it was very difficult to resist the pressure, but we did. And eventually they Visa withdrew the fund. I think had that fund been permitted to commence operations, it could have profoundly changed the mutual fund industry, because it would have established the notion that the investment of the fund, the investment of the fund's portfolio, can be determined at least in part by who sold the shares of the fund. And Visa was proposing to have restrictions. You know, the CDs would have to be of a certain quality, and the bank would have to have certain financial strength. But the basic principle that the investments of the fund have to be chosen with an eye single to their investment merit would have been lost. And I think that was a...
We've got to move along, but one sentence or two sentences, greatest tragedy.
I don't know if it was a tragedy. I think with a 2020 hindsight, where we had a number of money funds that were at risk of breaking the buck. You might recall, Dave, you and I had some late-night conversations where I would tell you someone's about to break the buck, and you'd go out and find some sugar daddies in the industry to step up and make sure it didn't happen. I don't know whether that was the right thing. I think maybe if one or two funds had gone down to 99 cents for a short time, the world would have been conditioned to the fact that it's not awful. You don't lose all the money. You just lose 1 or 2 cents, and it'll come back. And perhaps we wouldn't now have to have a Rule 2A7 quite as restrictive as it is.
And
we are just about at the 25th anniversary of the time I left the SEC. So my recollection, unlike everyone else at this table, I really basically left the practice of securities law and became a FCC commissioner and what have you. And since then, I've practiced mostly in communications field. I have been an independent director of fund group for 18 years, but my recollections are not nearly as vivid as yours, because I don't live with these things. But my overall recollection is, as has been stated by several, of a wonderful place to work with great people. The only negative of the whole, you know, but really didn't turn out to be a negative, but when I was nominated for a seat on the Federal Communications Commission, the Wall Street Journal editorialized against my appointment because I had tried to bring some kind of regulation of the Wall Street Letter, and they said I clearly was against the First Amendment because I was trying to regulate the written word, and I should not be an FCC commissioner. Unfortunately, no one paid any attention. But that is a tragedy, that whole area is so clouded with First Amendment obligations. I think probably the best place I ever worked. You know, it was 10 wonderful years, and history speaks for itself. I met great people, and I'm responsible for Joel Goldberg being, you know, whatever. Anyway, that's really all.
That's a mixed blessing.
Yeah, all right. Since it's been more than 35 years since I left the commission, I'm not going to restrict myself to comments of things that happened while I was at the commission. In terms of positives, one of the things that has really been of substantial benefit to the industry is the advancement and proliferation of series companies. And I think the staff has done a great deal in terms of interpretations and no action letters to facilitate that. And I think that has gone a long way towards helping the industry grow as rapidly as it has. And it has also been very helpful for the smaller complexes to create a larger variety of funds at a reduced cost. A second major development happened very recently, and it's the move to corporate governance and the strengthening of the role of directors and getting them independent counsel. I think the downside of that one is it should have happened 20 or 30 years earlier than it did, and I think it would have been a positive to the industry. The final positive, I think, is the money market funds, and they have been, in my judgment, one of the key reasons why the fund industry has developed and acquired so much assets during the 80s and 90s and so forth. On the downside, 12B1, I think, really needs to be revisited. I think that it's now becoming a method for the brokerage industry to siphon off assets out of the funds, and I think that so much of the money just goes right through to pay brokers, and I think that whole thing ought to be reconsidered. Secondly, I don't think that the staff has paid enough attention to emphasizing disclosure relative to after-tax returns. And I think that there has been talk about it and so forth, but I think it's a much more significant issue to investors than anybody realizes. Similarly, I don't think there has been enough attention to after expense returns, including if you would include 12B1 as an expense. And I think those two things would, if they were better known, would make people realize why a no-load S&P 500 index fund may, in the long term, be the best investment that you could make. But that just hasn't really come to pass yet.
Marty?
I got to lead the life that Barry wanted to have because I got to be the regulatory father of money market funds. Nobody else wanted it. After it started with Allen, went through part of Ann's administration, and ended up in SIDS, and what, of course, we had is people challenging the commission's position, which was very conservative, mark to market or else. We had the choice between amortized cost and penny rounding. We also had people filing applications like crazy, so we had to figure out what to do with it. And after the commission set it down for hearing, there was no way to stop the applications from coming in. So we ended up at one point in having 40 people, 40 different fund groups in a hearing, and trying to figure out how to deal with each of them as a party. And the party kept getting larger. So the first thing we did was settle out everybody who would swallow penny rounding on the grounds that if something could be developed later on amortized cost, they could have that too. It is not fun, Barry, to have your boss be an administrative law judge who could care less about policy and have ex-party rules where you can't talk to the five commissioners who appointed you. When you are trying to make decisions and the ALJ is the next person you get to talk to, it sucks. And Dr. Golke did a great job of being our expert witness, but it wasn't easy. Corralling all those people, getting them to settle and then getting them to waive the ex parte rules so that I could go talk to the commissioners privately was incredibly hard. We started the process. It was started in 1975 by the commission telling people to mark the market. We didn't settle the thing until August of 79. For most of the year that we were in the hearing, I built a triangular stack of Maalox bottles demonstrating which of the people had been the most unpleasant for the last week.
Marty, is this the triumph or the tragedy?
This is the triumph.
Okay.
Oh, no.
We have a...
I realize
it's a tragedy.
The result is we've watched money market funds be something that was astonishing, and at one point they completely destabilized the banking industry. Right now it's the money's going absolutely the other way. So my proudest achievement is the money market funds. The tragedy is the same thing. Somebody insisting on getting what they wanted, and instead of getting it administratively, they went to the Hill, and we ended up with the BDC amendments, which have been used by very few people. It's unbelievably complicated. There, you and I and three other people who also like baseball can probably figure them out, and it's been ill used, and it was all a result of one person wanting his way.
Well, but if I can add a footnote to that, it's ironic that we went along and tried to work out something for the industry, and we made it so complicated they couldn't use it, which is what we wanted from the start, I think.
On that, I'm not sure, down note or up note or sideways note, I think we're about at an end. If I can cast a positive, on the positive side, I would agree with Barry, Ed, and Marty. I think the most extraordinary achievement of the division was the creation, definition of money market funds and Rule 2A7, really almost out of whole cloth. And with that, Carla, I think you have your tape. And thank you all, and we can adjourn.
Thank you. Okay.